My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the honor and privilege of speaking to Trevor Richardson. Trevor, I don't have to welcome you to Portland because you live here.
That's right. I live here.
Yeah.
2 years now.
2 years? Well, where'd you come from?
New York before that, Texas before that, and California before that.
Okay. New York? How long were you in New York?
2 years in New York.
Yeah? Where'd you live?
Just upper Manhattan, in an apartment with about seven people.
Only way to fly. You weren't a couch surfer, then?
No.
Okay.
I had a place.
Good for you.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Title of your book is American Bastards, interesting title, and it's published by Inkwater Press. When I read this book, I thought I was real clever in thinking, well, this guy has obviously been listening to a lot of Bob Dylan, especially, I think, Gates of Eden, Subterranean Homesick Blues, there's one other one, Desolation Row.
That's very much. That's my favorite, second favorite Bob Dylan song after Tombstone Blues. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, the book is just full of that kind of cascading, semi surreal images.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. I spent a lot of the 60s and at various states of consciousness. talking endlessly, free associating, kind of surrealist raps while listening to Dylan and other things.
Right.
And reading this book took me back to that kind of thing.
That's
yeah.
great. I wish it could have taken me back, but I missed it by, you know,
a few years.
A number of years. Right?
Well, a lot of it wasn't very nice.
So. That's very true. That's true. It's become sort of, you know, glorified, I guess you could say. You know,
absolutely.
We, through guys writing books like mine.
Well, it's not just that. It's just that people my age, you know, you tend to forget the really bad stuff, and you know, the old rosy glow kicks in, and people don't remember that if you had long hair in those days, sometimes people would cross the street to spit at you and call you names. Mm-hmm. But that's neither. And there was a war going on.
There was a war going on, among other things. Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. There's two wars going on now. Okay. There are two parallel stories going on in here.
Correct.
There's Jack. Mm-hmm. Jack's wife has cheated on him, and he's kind of taken off on a road trip. Is that a...
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. That's fair.
And he has no idea what's going on in his life.
He's completely lost everything. Jack built his entire life, his entire destiny, his perception of reality even on his faith and, by association, the woman that he married, because that was what he was taught you were supposed to do as a good Christian lad.
And
when that was gone, he had nothing. He had no reality.
You know, I missed telling a little about you. You used to be a child preacher.
I was. I started preaching just a little before I turned 14.
Uh-huh.
I moved from California to Texas, and I can't even begin to describe the culture shock of that, you know, like just going from... One lifestyle, the West Coast lifestyle, to the proverbial buckle of the Bible Belt, you know, and I didn't fit, and I had, I literally had people every day asking me if I was a surfer or if I was gay. And
the only two possibilities.
Right, you're from California. You must be. You're probably both of these.
A gay surfer,
you know? And so my right, exactly. Yeah. So my first year there was one of profound anger, and I ultimately found the church the way many people do. It was the only place where I could fit, where I could belong, and I don't know what it is necessarily that led me to start preaching, because I was impossibly shy. Still,
you didn't
am.
Get a call. You didn't. The Spirit didn't visit you or anything like that.
I think, you know, I would have said that at the time, but looking back, I think mainly it was just, you know, this was a scene, and I thought I could do it better than anyone else. And so I just started talking.
Were you a verbal kid? Were you excessively intelligent?
Yeah, with English and, you know, language arts and all that. Terrible at math, like most creative people are, you know. So I would bomb out on an algebra test and get 100% on a composition I wrote, kind of a thing. And so I think I just kind of took those skills and used that to say what I thought the Bible meant. And before I knew it, people were inviting me to their church. I was traveling around. I was getting
paid.
Were
these sanctified churches? Or were
Yeah.
So you weren't like a Methodist or a Presbyterian?
No,
or
it was. I was technically in a Southern Baptist church, but most of the churches in the area were pretty non-denominational and open. You know, just, you know, play with the acoustic guitar, and everybody hung out and sung. You know, it was good for me at the time. You know, in spite of the fact that I now have negative things I could say about my experiences and whatnot. It was a good way to grow up. It was a good way to find your mind and find the courage to be able to say things that you thought were true, even if they weren't popular. I mean, I often would get up there, 15-year-old kid, and say, the cross is completely overrated. We're focusing on a plank of wood rather than the man, you know, and things like that. And
that's not a bad thing to say.
Right. And I would get cheers and jeers alike, you know, and I guess somewhere that's sort of transitioned into a writing career and the desire to write things that aren't safe. Mm-hmm. You know, the desire, I think, for most people, because it's safer to try to market it. It's safer to try to sell your book if it's going to apply and appeal to as many people as possible, is to write something safe and cushy and formalized, you know, and I just don't really want to do that. Even if nobody buys my book, at least I have some principle.
Let me ask you a question. Sure. Were you created as a skeptic by your experience in the church, or did your natural skepticism finally emerge after a while?
The second one.
Yeah?
The second one. And I think my mom and dad for that more than anything. My entire life, they taught me more how to think than what to think. And the process of thinking critically and being a skeptic, like you just said, ultimately led me to want more. I wanted more from theology than I was finding. I wanted more from the scriptures than I was finding. And ultimately, I always was coming back to the same old pat responses. And eventually that wasn't good enough, and so I started looking elsewhere and ended up here.
Yeah. Well, it's not a bad place to be. Let's see now. The other parallel story involves Tom Sawyer, of all people.
Correct.
And basically the plot motivator there is he's stuck in the Hotel California. That's where you can check in, but you can't check out.
Exactly. And took the song quite literally there. Yeah.
Yes. And he's trying to get out of there, and the kid is surrounded by the shades of dead rock stars and writers.
Right.
And he doesn't understand what the hell really is happening, how he got there, and what he has to do to get out. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment. The thing that makes Tom different from everybody else in the hotel is he doesn't actually recall ever checking in. And this makes him somewhat special. On top of that, the fact that Tom Sawyer is famously a clever boy, and so he has people from all sides trying to use him to get out because they don't want to be there either.
I'm going to force you to defend a decision now because...
Sure.
I read Tom Sawyer 10 times before I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how much I love that book. Mm-hmm. And when I read Huckleberry Finn, it put Tom Sawyer in absolute perspective about what a little phony weenie he really was.
Yeah, totally.
And Huck Finn was really the one with the soul and with the courage and the mental strength.
Huck
Why did you pick Huck?
This kind of reminds me of a conversation I had with my brother not long ago. I'm going to use a Star Wars reference, if that's okay.
Please do.
He told me, you know, watching the movie, everybody wishes they're Han Solo. He's the space pirate who gets the girl. He's the cool guy with the cool buddy in the ship, you know, which is the space equivalent of the cool car. Everybody wants to be Han, but we all know we're just the geeky farm boy who...
From Tatooine,
right. Yeah. Who, you know, and, you know, maybe we all don't rise to the occasion the way this character eventually does, but the fact of the matter is, you know, most of us aren't really the guy with the cool car. Most of us are the guy who grew up in the small town, you know.
And that's a good answer.
You know, and that's Tom. Tom for me. I am Tom. As much as I have tried to be Huck, I've lived in my car and I've wandered around America and I've couch surfed and I've drawn portraits of people on the street for petty change just to get food. I've done all this stuff, you know, but I always felt I was doing it because I wanted to be Huck, not because I actually was him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how you know you're Tom, if you're the phony who's trying to be something you're not, you know.
It just occurs to me, talking to you now, that Huck Finn would have had no trouble getting out of the Hotel California.
Exactly. He probably would have just punched his way out.
That's right. Okay, well, I read this book a few weeks ago, so now I'm trying to remember. There's a place called Americana, there's a place called Subterranea, mm-hmm. and there's a place called Otherworld. Are those three different places? Or
those are all three different
things?
Places. Americana is more or less the name I chose for this other world, this other reality, let's say, other dimension, where Tom is from. Jack is from the real world, and Tom is from Americana. The way we would call our reality Earth, he would call his reality Americana. And it was just sort of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying everything from American culture exists in this place and is personified in some way. Subterranea is just the town that they're in. And it's a very strange town, and it has a lot of problems that are addressed in the book. And then the question of otherworld is actually what they call where we're from, and it's sort of a myth in their culture, and not everybody knows if it's actually a real place or not. You know, the way we talk about the Bermuda Triangle leading to other dimensions or something like that, they would talk about us from otherworld. Mm-hmm. And Tom periodically stumbles through doorways into otherworld, and Jack periodically stumbles into Americana, and eventually they collide.
What's Jack looking for?
I think Jack is looking for a way to define his reality and to find himself without the faith that he's lost and without the wife that he's lost. He's sort of given himself away. He's given his perspective away to all these outside sources. And once they're gone, he realizes he has no idea who he is, and he never knew. And so his trip and his sort of experimentation with all the things that he's abstained from because of his faith and his all of his long-winded dialogue and everything with his friends, I think is all about him trying to figure out who he is now that his world's kind of fallen apart.
Those scenes are really familiar to me, sitting around with your buddies trying to decide. Yeah. The princess and the prince discuss what's real and what is not.
Yeah, you know, there you go. Yeah.
We all came from, you know, more or less privileged backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, we attempted to create ourselves as a subculture, a despised subculture, which we kind of liked being after being the fair-haired kids, you know?
Yeah, it sounds familiar.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And there's a lot of those kinds of discussions mm-hmm. in here.
Yeah, and many of them, I won't say all of them, I definitely took artistic liberties, but many of them are real conversations I had. The experience Jack has with being married young and losing his wife and all that really did happen to me. I was led by the elders of my church and many people that I respected and looked up to get married young and to go into ministry. And I thought that's what God wanted me to do and all of that. Yeah, I found myself exactly where Jack ends up. And I went to the same town I write about. I went to Denton, Texas, and I basically shacked up with friends that I'd lost touch with and sort of tried to go back to a point in time before this woman came along and before I had struck out on the path that I chose, and I kind of tried to start over.
Pushing the reset button,
kind of regressing in a way, yeah. You know, and to go back to Bob Dylan, you know, he has that famous statement where he said, I've thought a lot about youngness, and it's taken me a long time to get young. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And,
I was
and
so much older than
I was I'm so much older than, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I think I, in an earnest desire to do right and to impress my parents even, and to impress myself and to win or curry God's favor, and somehow I was a very, very old soul, as they say. And the year I spent with these friends in Denton was about finding youngness, something mm-hmm. that I had overlooked in a great way. And
Always you need.
And I think in the end, I've actually been looking the book back over because I wrote it quite a while ago. It just took me a long time to get it published. But
I know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
So I've been looking over it and kind of rereading it and finding things in there I didn't even really mean to put together. But in the end, I think the book is about the fact that you know more when you're young, I think, sometimes than when you get older and you get caught up in so many of your assumptions and
hold that thought.
Sure thing. Yeah.
I'd like to remind the listeners that I'm speaking with Trevor Richardson. The title of his book is American Bastards, and it's published by Inkwater Press. The idea that we know things when we're young that we forget later on, it's always a trade-off because we believe things when we're kids that are naive and come from a lack of experience. And the idea is to maintain a certain amount of innocence and naivete, even in the face of experience as you get older. And that's really always been the struggle for me. So,
I think you summed up what I was awkwardly trying to get out, but yeah, that's,
oh no, please.
That's exactly it. There's, in my life, I think the ultimate failure that got me to the point that I wound up being at was that I threw out youngness and replaced it with oldness rather than trying to find a balance, which ultimately almost anything in life is about balance and equilibrium. And I didn't have that. I was rushing ahead. I was rushing to be married. I was rushing to be a pastor. I was rushing to be a grown-up, whatever that meant. And I don't even think I knew what that meant. And I threw out so many wonderful things, friendships that I've never had better ones, you know, friends than the friends that I had when I was in junior high and high school, guys I'm still in touch with now, guys that I wrote about in the book, you know, and I threw all of those things out because they didn't apply to me anymore because it was time to grow up, you know. And so at least in my case, to figure out who I was, I had to go backwards. It's like that old adage about if you take a, you know, wrong turn at the fork in the road, the only way to get right is to backtrack and go back to that fork in the road. That's what that time in my life was.
This book is also rummaging through the cultural dumpster of two generations.
It very much is. Yeah. That's very eloquently put. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Feel free to steal it.
Yeah.
I'd say, one of the characters is Maggie May from the song by Rod Stewart.
Rod Stewart, right.
Yeah. Miss Molly is in here. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Hotel California. The references and the... corollaries to everything that Bob Dylan put in those great middle period songs. That's all in here. What have you got against Yellow Submarine, by the way?
You know, honestly, I don't have as much against it now as I did when I wrote the book. But but when I wrote the book, it was this this thing that I was continuously running into. And to answer this question, I think I might have to explain something about this area of Texas, if
Please.
You don't know. Texas is... a very, very confused place. It has so many different types of people, and it's a really huge place. I mean, you can divide it into so many subsections with so many different dialects and cultures and pastimes even. But one of the common things in the area that I grew up in is this harsh line drawn between the sort of athletic, jock-minded, hunter, you know, drive my Ford truck type of people, and the people who don't fit into that at all, the minority, who find refuge in art and culture.
You mean Austin?
And music. Austin is a good example. I came from a tiny little town called Linden, Texas. Its only claim to fame is that it's allegedly the hometown or the birthplace or something of Don Henley from the Eagles. Like, and that's so and they
Lubbock
milk that.
And Buddy Holly. And,
yeah, there you go. Yeah, and they milk that for everything they can get out of it. But anyway, I don't want to digress too much. The point is, these people end up being really amazing talented artists because it's their only escape. It's their only refuge. But every now and then you'll run into somebody who wants to be a part of that world, but still is truthfully just the guy who wants to play football and, you know, date a cheerleader and beat up a guy like me in high school, you know? And those guys are the guys who are like, oh, you guys talking about the Beatles? Yeah. Yellow Submarine. That's my favorite song, you know? And that's where that grudge came from at this time in my life. It's the same as, somebody who wants to sound like they know Shakespeare will reference Romeo and Juliet because we all know Romeo and Juliet, you know? And, so anyway, at the time in my life, I was 20 when I wrote the book and I was a young punk and I was just kind of mad. Anytime even somebody said the word Yellow Submarine, I was like, you're just another one of those phonies. And never even allowed for the chance that somebody might actually just legitimately like that song.
I legitimately like that song. Yeah. When it came out. First of all, it was a Ringo song.
Right. Yes. One of what, yeah. Two? Three? Yeah,
there may be a half a dozen.
Yeah, you there know, you go.
That you remember, but that's certainly one of them. How old are you?
I'm 25 and a half.
25 and a half. The reason I ask is that you've absorbed so much of stuff that happened years before you were born.
I was just told this by somebody else as well. A relative of my girlfriend said the same thing.
I mean, like, it could be Mozart because it all happened before you were born. You know.
I don't know. It just made sense to me. I can actually remember. I believe ninth grade in high school. I was in a U.S. history class and not paying attention, didn't care. It was going over the same old stuff I'd heard 100 times before. And I was flipping through the book and I actually found a chapter, surprise, surprise, on the Beat Generation in this book that was not part of the curriculum. And I just read it and reread it.
Was it judgmental and disdainful?
Not so much, but even the parts that were, I liked it, you know, it made me more interested, right. And that might be why it wasn't part of the curriculum. But I have to give credit to that teacher. He kind of came up and rushed at me like, you're not paying attention, and saw what I was looking at and just kind of patted me on the shoulder and left me alone. And I think that might have been where it all started.
Beat. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And he introduced me to a lot of music from there. He's the guy that taught me about the band, you know, Robbie Robertson,
right,
and all
yes.
those guys, Levon Helm. He taught me about just so much music that I just wasn't exposed to at all.
This conversation has a dangerous tendency to spin off and just sitting here and talking about our favorite
records. It's very true, yeah.
Yes. But I don't want to do that. One concept that in this book that really knocked me out was the liar's crutch. Mm. What's a liar's crutch?
Liar's crutch is actually what we were just talking about. The guy that doesn't know that whatever he's trying, let's say he's trying to impress a girl by saying, I know all about Shakespeare. And the crutch is the famous play that's required reading in high school. That doesn't require any more from you than that. Everybody knows Shakespeare, everybody knows Romeo and Juliet.
So we did it conceptually before I actually ask you the question.
Yeah, exactly, right. And the thing is, the point of the liar's crutch is there are so many things embedded in our culture that you don't actually have, it doesn't require anything of you. You just know them, you sort of absorb them. We've all seen the Baz Luhrmann film of Romeo and Juliet, yeah. You know, and so you can watch this movie and never even read the play or see the play done in the proper way. And at the time, the same went for Yellow Submarine, or the same would go for candies and or chocolates and flowers on a date or something. Just all these cliche things.
It's like the guys in the 60s that bought the Nehru jackets and the medallions. Yeah. And thought they were hipsters. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, it's just anything that you can use without actually having to earn, I suppose.
Okay. There's a shady group here whose acronym is MARTYR. Tell us about MARTYR.
That's true. Yeah. MARTYR, you know, and to be honest, I might actually have to crack my own book open to remember what MARTYR stood for. But basically...
The actual acronym, I don't know.
It's an acronym. MARTYR is a group of people who are aware that the world they live in is connected to our world, and we're sort of creating them and they're creating us. And they see a war coming between two different forms of thought, two different value systems, a creative value system and a sort of ad campaign market-based sort of business mentality, and they view it as ugly, and the other guys view them as ugly, and they're trying to dominate one another. And this sort of cabal of famous rock stars who want to save the world more or less contact in some form both characters and are trying to get them to find one another and use them as, you could almost say, agents in the field to try to save the world, to try to save the art world. Because there are other forces out there that are trying to dominate it. And
did you feel a little funny? The personalities that you've given to these rock stars are kind of what their public personalities were.
Yes.
Did you feel in any way shaky about that, thinking, well, you know, this is, I'm using a liar's crutch here?
No, that was actually a deliberate thing. The people that you're reading aren't really intended to be the real guys. They're the copies we've created of them as a culture. They're the sort of legendary personas. And that's why, you know, Hunter S. Thompson is probably more aggressive than he would have been in real life. And that's why, you know, people are saying, you know, things like, you know, hip and dig and cat, you know, probably didn't say them as much as we all think they did. But I did that intentionally. I did it as sort of a subtle way to say, these guys are what you think they are. They're not the real thing.
I actually marked page 149 in this book where that very explanation you just made is given. There's also a chapter 14 in this book. It's one of the last chapters in the book. And it's, to me, in a way, it encapsulates the whole book in that little road trip that's taken.
All right.
Yeah. When you sat down to write this book, did you write it in a fever? I mean, it all just come pouring out of you. Was it something that had been building up for years, or did you work on this like a dog? I mean,
it's a lot of both, actually. Or actually, you may have given me three choices. Anyway, it's everything. I wrote the first draft in 2 months, and it was a completely different book. It was wacky and almost like,
oh, this is pretty wacky.
It was more wacky. It was
you've
like I wanted to be Burroughs, and I wanted to write.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, I wanted exactly. Yeah, I wanted to write my own Naked Lunch, basically. And
I want to be Cary Grant. I about as much chance as you do.
Exactly. Yeah, and I realized that. I mean, that there was a lot of to use a word we used a minute ago, there was a lot of naivete behind the writing of this book. And I aged with it, and I took things out and put things in, rephrased, whatnot. But the main thrust of writing the book happened after I finished the first draft, when I was bothered by what it came out to be. I didn't like it. I hated it. I actually almost deleted the whole thing from my computer and threw away
my
notebooks.
Never do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I started dreaming about it. And this is going to sound really weird, I'm sure. Everybody I tell, they're like, no way, you're lying. But I started dreaming about it and having these very vivid, very detailed, elaborate dreams. And so I began keeping a notebook beside my bed, and I would wake up in the night and I would write down what I dreamt. And that became most of the Tom Sawyer plotline, as well as a lot of the more like stream of consciousness weird stuff that happens to Jack later in the book. And there were literally, I kid you not, there were nights where I woke up and I had the notebook on my belly and I had written and I didn't remember waking up and writing. And it could have been that state you're in where you go to the bathroom and you don't remember getting up to go to the bathroom. Or it could have literally just been sleep writing. I don't know. But it would be, you know, crazy, like words going diagonally in, you know, huge font and then tiny swirling things, you know, and I had to translate it and transcribe it. And some of it was illegible. But yeah, most of the stuff in the book that I'm the most proud of, I actually wrote in my sleep.
Well, that's okay, because then all your defenses are down and the real thing comes out. Mm-hmm. So I
think the sort of secondary effect of writing a book in that way is it became a very subconscious book. It was very much about my own psyche and what was troubling me and things that I didn't know about myself until after I wrote the book, literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's they just said that writing is the cheapest form of psychotherapy.
That's very true.
What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm very busy with trying to promote the book in creative ways.
Where can we get the book?
The book's available in a lot of Portland bookstores. Broadway Books has it. I know Annie Bloom's in Multnomah Village has it. A few others.
Does Palace have it?
Can you get Palace to have it? They don't have it yet.
Okay, yeah.
No, I've sent them one and we're working on that, and I'm hoping this interview might actually be the last little push through that
well,
we need.
But good for you.
They're kind of the holy grail for writers in this area.
I guess they are.
What am I working on? Right. The main thing I'm working on is promoting the book in unusual ways. And I would love to just look back on my life and say I became an expert on ridiculous publicity stunts to make a book work, you know.
How about graffiti?
I'm thinking about it. If I can find a way to do it without it coming
without
back
arrested.
To me, right? Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna make a lot of the Highway Zero sign, which is pictured on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going on a road trip this July, and I'm going to just tack the sign up all over America.
Do what Buddy Holly did. Throw a couple of cases of the books in the back of your car and drive
the
books
exactly.
to a bookstore.
Yeah, totally. That's part of it. I'm planning a sort of what I think is a growing Portland trend, you know, the themed pub crawl. I'm actually planning a novel-themed pub crawl where people are invited to dress up like the icons depicted in the book and, mm-hmm. you know, and... just come and hang out with me and have fun. But anyway, in terms of writing, I have started a new project that's still in its infant state, and I'm not entirely sure.
You don't have
I could
to talk
go
about it.
Yeah.
So I know some people are nervous about that. It's been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Trevor Richardson. The title of his book is American Bastards. It's published by Inkwater Press and Andy Bloom's or what was the other one?
Broadway Books.
Broadway
has
Books
it,
right here on the east side.
Others,
yeah.
And it's also available online. Yeah. Pretty much every retailer
What's the,
has
where,
it.
Where can I get it online?
You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at the Inkwater Press website. You can get it at pals.com, which is funny that they have it on their site. And not
Inkwater,
story.
InkwaterPress.com.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming in.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's been a thrill.